bummers and what maybe really is going on between these two mega corporations?
Yeah, I mean, that was an interesting story laid out in the New York Times this weekend. And as you said, it was sort of this powwow. And, you know, actually, Keith Olbermann was on tonight. I don't know if he addressed it because he had been on vacation. And, you know, the creepy and disturbing part to me is, and Glenn Greenwald wrote about this online, is that this sort of truce had nothing to do with journalism. It had nothing to do with Fox News and MSNBC. It was the corporate parent, specifically MSNBC's parent of GE, which was becoming increasingly nervous about sort of the ripple effects. You know, Fox News claimed they were going to start investigating GE's ties to Iran and things like that. So this truce in and of itself is somewhat disturbing. Why should outside forces be telling, you know, Keith Olbermann, for instance, to stop fact-checking Bill O'Reilly? But it's doubly troubling because this didn't emanate from the news divisions. This didn't emanate from anyone who has anything to do with news. It had to do with sort of these corporate overlords who decided for corporate PR reasons that this sort of media feud had run its course and was and might be dangerous to the company. I mean, people have always been nervous that a corporate behemoth like GE, which is obviously in all kinds of industry, including defense, is running a news, a large news division. But the idea that, you know, the head of GE, again, strictly for PR reasons, would dictate what Keith Olbermann could say on the air about, Fox News, it does not bode well in terms of, you know, the continued consolidation, and it does not bode well, you know, just sort of for free speech.
Exactly, and so, you know, I think a very solid case could be made that Fox News, more than any other network, is a mouthpiece for one of the major political parties, the Republicans.
Fox News is now essentially the opposition party to the Obama White House.
Yeah, but, you know, you could talk about a bias on a part of any of these networks, but it seems it's really barefaced when it comes to Fox News, and for Obama not to be able to comment on that in the future seems it takes away many of the reasons why his show was more interesting than others.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, Eric, we've run out of time. I appreciate you sharing your analysis with us on all these issues, and I will recommend our listeners go to the website mediamatters.org, where you can see a lot of interesting video clips, listen to some audio clips about the critique that your group Media Matters has on a lot of what our major corporate media is doing out there. But I appreciate, again, you making time for us, Eric.
Talk to you soon.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Eric Bollert, Senior Fellow at Media Matters for America, mediamatters.org. Stay tuned. Just a clip here before we leave this topic from Glenn Beck.
At a beer fest.
Is unbelievable.
Why?
That is why?
Yeah, why?
For a teaching lesson, some sort of a who needs to learn what here? This president, I think, has exposed himself as a guy over and over and over again who has a deep-seated hatred for white people or the white culture. I don't know what it is, but you can't sit in a pew with Jeremiah Wright for 20 years and not hear some of that stuff and not have it wash over. What kind of president of the United States immediately jumps on the police? Just like what kind of president would ever say, oh, well, yeah, well, he's black. Of course he was breaking into the house.
This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKN in Bridgeport. WPKN in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. And my name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint. We're glad you could join us tonight. And still up, we'll be having a discussion in not too long about the Connecticut state budget impasse from the perspective of working families and the public service employees. And we'll be joined by Leo Canty here from the AFT Connecticut Union. So stay tuned for that. But right now I'm very happy to introduce to you Father Luis Berrios, Chair and Professor of the Department of Latin America and Latina Studies at John Jay College of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York. Father Berrios recently served a two-month jail sentence for committing nonviolent civil disobedience at the 2008 School of the Americas protest at Fort Benning, Georgia. And we're here tonight to talk a bit about what's going on vis-a-vis the Honduras coup and the forces of U.S. involvement in that coup, supporting it, or maybe having backed it to begin with early on. But right now, Father Berrios, thanks so much for being here tonight.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for allowing me to be in your program.
So, Father Berrios, tell our listeners a bit about the School of the Americas Watch, so those who may not be familiar with the work of that organization can know a little bit of the background as to how you served the recent two-month prison sentence for civil disobedience.
Well, first, the School of the Americas Watch is an organization. It's a Pacific organization that was practically founded by Father Bourgeois. And a lot of people have been part of this organization that the intention is to not only close the School of the America, which is located right now here in the United States, in Atlanta, Columbus, Atlanta, but also to build together an agenda to go against any military agenda that continue promoting USA imperialism and occupation of other lands all over the places in the world. So we've been trying, we're still trying, we're going to continue trying to close the School of the America, who is right now here in the U.S., founded by tax money, federal tax money, which is not correct for the purpose that they've been using the School of the America to train Latin American soldiers that they bring from Latin America here, and they send them back and committing a lot of atrocities in Latin American countries, human rights violation, most of them organizing death squads, similar to what's going on right now in Honduras, which one of the leaders of this coup, General Romeo Orlando Vasquez, is one of the graduates of this School of America.
Well, Father, tell us a bit about this connection you just mentioned. What does the United States Army School of the Americas, now renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, what does that institution have to do with the coup in Honduras?
Well, we need to understand from a historical perspective that when the School of the Americas was created in the 1940s in Panama, was with the intention of at least two things. One is to validate and protect USA foreign policy to Latin America, but at the same time to protect those government that they were willing to allow the USA foreign policy be implemented in those countries. So it's a double responsibility. And the way to do this, yes, you have all these doctrines that came out in the 19th century, like, for example, Manifest Destiny, the issue of the doctrine of the good neighbor, Monroe Doctrine, all this is a continuation of the way the U.S. was going to implement the USA foreign policy in Latin America. Right now, under the Bush, first the Bush administration, and now the Obama administration, they started calling it smart power. But it's the same. Manifest Destiny, Monroe Doctrine, Good Neighbor Doctrine is the same. The issue is U.S. imperialism, occupation, colonialism of the lands in Latin America, and then placed in governments that are going to respond to their own interests and protecting this government. So that's the reason why they need to bring people here, being trained from a military perspective, and then sending them back.
And Father Barrios, name the names here again, if you would. Who among the Honduran military that executed this coup d'etat against the democratically elected president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya, who among that group of officers was connected with the School of the Americas, the U.S. School of the Americas?
Well, the intention was to put Roberto Micheletti as the president, but in order to do this, they went into the head of the Joint Chief of Staff, General Romeo Orlando Vasquez Velasquez. He's been trained in the School of the America twice, and together with him, we have more militaries, because we need to understand that Honduras has been playing a very significant role for U.S. imperialism in Latin America. More specifically, with the Soto Cano base, it's a military base that is controlled by the USA government. It was the same place that they were doing all kinds of atrocities when the Sandinista government was in power in the 1980s in Nicaragua. So this is the place, Honduras. Okay, it's always been playing a key role, performer. So people most of the time do not hear this name, but they've been playing, at least in Central America, the major emphasis in USA imperialism. Like Orlando, Romeo Orlando Vasquez, we have a lot of militaries that also play the same role. And then they're going to look for some kind of civilian, like Roberto Micheletti. It's a topic. They put him in power, but the power behind that is these militaries that are being trained by the School of the America.
And Father Barrios, tell us a bit about the issue of the Obama administration's public lack of support for this coup. The Obama administration has come out foursquare against the coup d'etat in Honduras, but there are many who question their motives behind the scenes and some of the actions of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in dealing with this crisis. Can you give us your views on that?
Oh, yes. It's not. Listen, when there's a coup in Latin America, nothing is going to happen with all these militaries. The USA embassy is not involved. So historically, this is a reality. You go back into what's going on in Latin America, and you're going to discover this. When you look at the performance that Hugo Jordans, who is the USA ambassador to Honduras, a Cuban American, who now he recognized that he was in a meeting where they were planning to overthrow Zelaya. So Hugo Jordans is not going to do things like this without consulting with the President of the United States, which is Obama. So when it comes to put names, Hillary Clinton knew about this, Obama knew about this, so that means that the White House was aware, the Pentagon was aware, the Congress was aware, because they've been putting money. And the whole issue was to stop the referendum that was going to happen in Honduras. It was more a consultation to the people to do an amendment to the Constitution of Honduras, which is a democratic process. But again, you have at least three pledges in Honduras that they've been blessed by the Obama administration and before the Obama administration, Bush and the other people. One is the ruling class in Honduras. The second is the leadership of the church, and this includes not only the Catholic Church, but also the Protestant Church. And then you have the militaries. But these three together, similar to what happened in Venezuela, similar to what happened in Brazil, in Paraguay, in Argentina, in Chile, all of these two groups, they're going to function only if the USA government gives them the authorization to do it. And it's not a secret anymore. Yes, it was planned in the USA embassy, and they did it. What the Obama administration is doing is playing a double standard here, openly saying, I'm against the coup. Okay, the liar is the president. But you listen to what he's saying, but what else is doing? Nothing. He then went into negotiating with those people who did the coup. You do not negotiate with these people. You give them the order. You have to step out. Get out. You're not the legal government in Honduras. So they've been killing time. It's already more than 1 month after June 28th. Killing time, and now they're running a campaign to discredit President Zelaya in the middle of this operation. So the media is playing an incredible role in this panic that they're creating all over the places.
We're speaking tonight on Counterpoint with Father Luis Barrios, Chair and Professor of the Department of Latin America and Latina Studies at John Jay College of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York. Father Barrios is also active with the group School of the Americas Watch, a campaign, long-running campaign, to close the U.S. Army School of the Americas, also named or renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, that trains soldiers and officers from Latin America at Fort Benning in Georgia. Father Barrios, there are a lot of names that have risen to the surface that may be connected with this coup d'etat that are not necessarily in the U.S. government anymore, and they are former Bush administration advisor Otto Reich, Clinton, former advisor to Bill Clinton, Lonnie Davis, and the institution known as the National Endowment for Democracy, which supplies funds to the John McCain's Republican Institute for Democracy. Tell us a little bit about what you know of these individuals' involvement in the coup, if any.
Okay, yes, also John Negroponte is another one who has been playing a significant role. And all these people, which is very interesting, after the Iran-Contra scandal, the National Endowment for Democracy was the one who really took the leadership in not only putting the money, but also training people to promote the USA foreign policy, how to overthrow governments that goes against this policy in different places. More specific, what we're talking right now in Latin America. So, yeah, it's talking about Otto Reich, which is another Cuban-American, one of the leaders in Latin America for all this crazy USA foreign policy, first with Reagan, then with George Bush's father, then with George Bush's son, and he's still playing as a consultant for the Pentagon. He's still playing a very significant and powerful role when it comes to deal with Latin American's issue. Part of what he's doing right now, Otto Reich, Negroponte, and Hugo Jorens, the USA ambassador, is to turn around the issue that is going on in Honduras, and they're trying to bring people misleading that the person responsible for all the atrocities going in Honduras is Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. In other words, that Hugo Chavez is the problem, not that they did an illegal coup in Honduras, and they've been thinking about this and implementing this not only in Honduras, because they've been trying to do this in Ecuador, Bolivia, Honduras, and now they're very scared what's going to happen in Nicaragua, and that's why they need to take control of Honduras.
Father Barrios, what about the grassroots organizations in Honduras itself? What are they doing to restore Manuel Zelaya to his office of the presidency there?
Well, they've been working very strong. Student organization, religious organization, workers' organization. What's going on, Scott, is that the general media is being controlled by the ruling class that is also behind this coup. So in order to get the real picture of what's going on in Honduras right now, you need to go into alternative media, independent media, because this corporate media is not going to allow you to see or hear what is going on in Honduras at this moment. Right now we have here in New York City a group of Honduran people, civil organization, grassroots organization. They were first in Washington. Now they are here in New York. They're going into Massachusetts. And this is what they've been doing. Just passing out the voice, letting people know what's going on in Honduras. They're still fighting. They're going to continue fighting. They're going to bring back President Zelaya. They're not going to give up. And you have a lot of these military that they already crossed the line because they don't want to be part of the coup anymore.
Father Barrios, so what specifically is John McCain's involvement vis-a-vis his organization, the International Republican Institute, which gets its money from the National Endowment for Democracy? Do we know if he's involved in any way, shape, or form in this coup d'etat?
Well, until at this moment, we're saying that yes, he's involved. The same issue when before the elections in Nicaragua, that they were running campaigns against the Sandinista government. They did the same in El Salvador, so they're very clear. So they knew that Zelaya was going to win the referendum, so they said we need to stop this before he wins the referendum because the amendment to the Constitution is going to happen. So these people, and it's something that we need to understand, these right-wing organizations are very well organized. They're very united. We need to learn from them, okay? And on top of that, they have the money. They have the human power. They have the money. That do not mean that we can't do nothing against them. Yeah, we can do a lot of things against them. But we can't underestimate them just because you don't see them in the open atmosphere leading a campaign. That do not mean that they are out of the game. They are there, and especially because the National Endowment for Democracy, this is the cornerstone. Okay, it's not the CIA anymore after Iran contract, so they've just, you know, cleaning the face of the USA foreign policy, and the National Endowment for Democracy is the one playing all these atrocities. And John McCain, my friend, he's one of the leaders in this coup.
Father Barrios, there has been a many-year effort to close down the U.S. School of the Americas, renamed WINSEC. What are the prospects that the Democratic-controlled House and Senate will cut off funds for the School of the Americas in the near term? Any predictions there about what might happen in Congress?
Well, if we follow some kind of analysis by probabilities, every year we're getting more votes in support of closing the School of America. What I've been telling people in this campaign is that we don't want to get into a situation similar to probably what's going to happen with Guantanamo. Oh, now we're going to celebrate because we closed Guantanamo. We have more than 245 secret military prisoners all over the places in the world. We need to go against all these institutions that violate human rights. So, yes, we want to close the School of America, but we have a lot of crazy institutions here putting money in all over the places in Latin America in order to train all these military that they're committing a lot of atrocity. And then the other issue of how then they utilize legal system to protect people who commit crime. Or probably government like this one that then they're going to harbor people like Orlando Bush. He's a terrorist. Okay? Luis Posada Carrillo, he's another terrorist. So you have some government that it's a safe haven to protect these people. So it's a package going on here. Yes, I really believe we're going to close the School of America. But I don't want to put all the energy that once we close the School of America, the campaign is in. No, We are going against anything that destroys human beings.
Well put, Father Barrios. And we are speaking with Father Luis Barrios, Chair and Professor of the Department of Latin America and Latina Studies at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. And Father Barrios, an activist with the School of the Americas Watch, a group trying to close down the U.S. Army School of the Americas for many years now. And I believe, Father Barrios, we have on the schedule November 20th through the 22nd this fall another of the mass rallies and protests against the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia, and that's going to be happening as a way to put more pressure on Congress to withdraw the funding for the school. You want to tell our listeners a little bit about the 2 months in prison that you just spent for committing nonviolent civil disobedience at last year's Fort Benning protest, and why you feel so passionate about this issue?
Well, I'm from Latin America. Okay, first, Puerto Rico is part of Latin America. We're the most important colony of the most powerful empire, which is the U.S. So they've been saying that we are not part of Latin America. We're part of Latin America, so I'm coming from Latin America. Second, I used to live in the Dominican Republic for 8 years, so I was close to experience the coup that happened against Juan Bosch, something that was cooked also in Washington, just because they don't want another Cuba in the Caribbean, that's what they say. I'm also part of Pastor for Peace, board of directors. Okay, so we are against the blockade that they, for more than 45 years, they put against the Cuban people in the island of Cuba. So, and I travel a lot for Latin America. So, yes, I experience all this reality, what's going on in Latin America, people struggling, people trying to survive, and then how this USA foreign policy destroyed democracy because they just want to make more money, and they don't care about human rights. So, yes, I have to be against this. So when it comes to deal with something like the School of the America, so yes, I said, well, I need to cross this gate. Okay, I have a commitment for Latin American people, and probably I'm going to go to prison for 2 months, but that's nothing when I compare with what's going on with all this death squad in Latin America. And, well, at that moment, I thought that probably I can go to prison. Then came out that, yes, you're going to prison. Then going to prison, yes, I'm proud that I was there becoming a federal inmate, just because I'm fighting for Latin American human rights. But then being there, becoming aware of another issue, the prison industrial complex that we have here in the United States, and we like to talk about democracy, but then inmates, they don't have any human rights. They don't have any civil rights. And I can tell you this because I experienced this. You have to beg for whatever is supposed to be human rights that the Constitution guarantees to you, like medical services or having something decent to eat. So, yes, I'm very passionate about this issue. I'm willing to do whatever is necessary to close the School of America. But now, after the incarceration, this issue of fighting against the prison industrial complex is also part of my political agenda.
Well, Father Barrios, will you be present at the School of the Americas protest this November? Or do you have some?
Yes. I'm going there with a group of students from John Jay College.
And it may be difficult for you to risk arrest again because they hit you harder every time you are arrested for civil disobedience.
No, I'm not going to do the civil disobedience this year, but I'm going to take a student there so they can experience what's going on there. And we continue building the solidarity and also supporting those who are going to cross the gate.
And our listeners can get more information about the annual protest this November 20th through the 22nd at Fort Benning, Georgia, by going to your website, right? What's the website they can go to?
It's soaw.org.
S-O-A-W. SOAW.org. And just one last word, if I could, Father Barrios, on the situation in Honduras. Do you have any feeling that President Zelaya will be restored to power, either through the direct action on the part of the people of Honduras or some outside force to negotiate his return? Are you optimistic or pessimistic about that?
I'm very optimistic. We put in a lot of pressure here. We put in pressure on the Congress. This is something that is something that the Obama administration do not know how to handle, the pressure. We believe that the international pressure is going all over the place and is getting a lot of heat with it. But also, I believe that the grassroots organization, they're going to bring Zelaya back. And Zelaya needs to take a very strong leadership in this. He is the president. He needs to take all the risk. I'm sorry things get out of control, that he can lose his life. I hope he do not lose his life. But he needs to be there leading his people. Okay? So these are the situation that, similar to Mahatma Gandhi, you lead the people all the way there, and you put your life there if it's necessary.
Well, Father Barrios, thank you so much for being here with us tonight. Thank you for all your work and putting your money where your mouth is in terms of your activism in trying to close the School of the Americas. And we'll all be following, of course, the story in Honduras. And I think in each of our own way, we need to let our voices be heard to the Obama administration so they don't try and play the double game that you referred to here tonight about publicly condemning the coup, but secretly and behind the scenes not doing what they could to restore President Zelaya to power. So
thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Thank you, Father Barrios. Take care.
Okay, God bless.
Bye-bye. Father Luis Barrios, Chair and Professor of the Department of Latin America and Latina Studies at John Jay College at the Criminal Justice, John Jay College of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York. Again, for more information on the School of the Americas Watch, go to their website, which is soaw.org. And we're going to take just a quick musical break here with some music from Peru. So stay tuned. We'll be back in just a couple of moments with a discussion of the Connecticut budget impasse and from the perspective of working families and public service employees. Stay tuned.
Caminho passando bem. Quem mostrava esse caminho longe? Quem mostrava esse caminho longe? Esse caminho passando bem. Saudade, 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 desse minha terra sem enclau. Saudade. Saudade, saudade, diz minha terra sem enclau. Quem mostrava esse caminho longe? Quem mostrava esse caminho longe? Esse caminho passando bem. Quem mostrava esse caminho longe? Quem mostrava esse caminho longe? Esse caminho passando bem. Saudade, 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 diz minha terra sem enclau. Saudade, 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 diz minha terra sem enclau. Se vou escrever, não está a escrever. Se vou esquecer, não está a esquecer. Até dia que vou voltar. Se vou escrever, não está a escrever.
This is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris here on WPKN in Bridgeport and WPKM in Montauk, New York. And right now, I'd like to welcome to the program Leo Canty, Vice President of the AFT Connecticut Union, which represents 26,000 state and municipal employees, private health care workers, and some nurses. Mr. Canty is the Connecticut at Work weekly columnist at the Journal Inquirer newspaper and an active member of the In This Together Connecticut Labor Citizen Coalition, which is representing the interests of working families and public service employees in this budget impasse here. Mr. Canty, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Yeah, it's great. Thanks for the invitation.
So I wonder if you would just kind of lay out what the state legislature now is confronting. There was a stalemate for many months, and no budget passed. We've just had Connecticut's Republican Governor Jody Rell proposed reductions in state spending by $1 billion and calling for $391 million in new taxes on alcohol and cigarettes and a temporary 3-year surcharge on corporate taxes. Give us your take on where this thing is headed in terms of the Democrats who control the state House and Senate and these new proposals by Jody Rell.
Well, let me say that I think the governor is in a box, at least in terms of trying to find a solution, which means that at this point in time, the whole state of Connecticut is in a box. We do have a severe budget deficit, as everybody knows about, which is basically the impact of a crisis in the economy. And what happens is that Connecticut suffered quite a bit. In fact, we probably had pretty close to the highest per capita deficit of all the states, in part because we had relied on revenue from the very wealthy to pay a lot of the tab, which means that the underlying problem that we have for our tax structure is it's just not a balanced portfolio when it comes to the appropriate level of taxes. So now the governor's in a box because she just doesn't want to increase taxes, mostly on the wealthy. But on the other hand, in these times, the way things are going, that's of all the bad decisions we have to make in terms of how we balance the budget in a recession like this, one of the best ones in that range are actually tapping into the incredible wealth that we have in the state, but not by much. You know, moving up a tax rate a percent or a percent and a half on incomes over $500,000 a year, we think, is actually a very palatable thing. But on the other hand, the people who might be, you know, the 100,000 or so families making over even $1 million a year, or it's the 80,000 or so people making over $1 million a year, might not like it. But when you look at the impact, it's really not great on those kinds of incomes. So currently, the legislature is at ease. So they're resting. They're on hold while budget negotiations continue between the governor and legislative leadership. And they're supposed to actually get together tomorrow morning at 9:30 or so at the governor's mansion to continue those talks. And so the legislature can't really vote on anything unless there's some kind of consensus about a workable plan. And so everybody's sitting on pins and needles waiting for some real arrangement or agreement to come into place.
What's your view of the sin taxes and the this escalation of corporate taxes on a temporary basis? Does that make sense to you in terms of a long-term solution, or is it just really a short-term fix? And would you accept or reject that, you know, from your perspective?
Well, at least in terms of the balanced tax portfolio that we should have, Connecticut, actually, as you well know and many other people know, right now in the whole spectrum of taxes, we're over-reliant on our property taxes. And so most states have a better balance where the property taxes don't occupy as much of the space to pay for all government services, including municipalities. But that's important to know because the state actually funds some of the municipalities, and if you don't have the revenue on the state side, then municipalities get cut off. So we go into this with kind of a messy tax structure to begin with. And so if we're not going to address those issues, which are the long-term problems that we need to find those solutions for, anything that you would do that doesn't look forward 2, 3, 5, 10 years down the road, I don't even think it could be called a short-term fix. And the way the governor, the way her math is working is that she's coming up with $300-400 million worth of taxes when we still have to fill a hole that's a billion to $2 billion short. So she's not even coming close to coming up with the kind of dollars we need to fix the problem. Now, she continues to say, let's cut, let's cut, let's cut. But on the other hand, every time you start slashing programs, you have people in need who are losing out. You have, kids in need of mental health services. You have elderly people who are not going to get the kind of services they need for long-term care. You have the blind who are getting their services cut. They want to cut the Lifestar. All these types of things that serve the regular working folks in the state and the people who are in need, when the difference is that if we would raise our rates on the higher incomes, which many of the states around us have done, would help to solve the problem. So specifically, the surcharge on corporations is something that's only temporary. That's not going to solve the problems. It may help get us through, but it's nowhere near enough to solve the problem. And we have supported, in a sense, the increases in taxes on alcohol and tobacco, in the sense that there's two things going. One being is that we really do have health issues with some of those things. So on the one hand, it helps in the long haul to try to help those people to discourage them from using those substances. But on the other hand, it's also a regressive tax, because the ones who use the most alcohol and tobacco tend to be the poor people. So when you look at it overall, it's great to include that as part of a package. But when the governor tries to make that almost all of her package, it just totally misses the mark.
Leo Canty is our guest, Vice President of the AFT Connecticut Union. And, Leo, you mentioned the cuts, the proposed cuts in education, health care, care for senior citizens and the blind. What is the real-life impact of these cuts if they go through? And we can discuss what the Democratic-controlled State House and Senate might do with those proposed cuts if they're going to move towards it or away from it. But what can you tell us about the impact on real people on the ground if these cuts were to be made part of the official budget?
Well, there's a number of things that will be at play. I mean, first of all, summertime for most things other than parks and recreation are slower times. People tend not to partake of a lot of the state services at this point in time, over the course of July and August. It's just a naturally slow time. We have about almost 4,000 state employees that went out of the door taking a retirement incentive. So that staffing is an issue. And so when people start paying attention again and going to the motor vehicle department, and although that's an issue on the chopping block, but the thing is that when you're staffed for a certain load and then a lot of those people leave and you don't replace them, you're guaranteeing yourself a poorer service structure that's there. And it will, as much as we need to automate certain systems, it takes time to implement the automation of certain systems to allow people to get there. So some of the direct impact are going to be dealing with some of the services that we all that we need to or participate in with the state. In terms of children, when you cut back education funding, which a lot of municipalities are doing, that means larger class sizes. That means the types of things that are not going to enhance our education program but are going to take away from it. If you look at the Lifestar helicopter, it's just $1 million in the budget. But on the other hand, you hope you're not the one that gets in a car accident some night on a highway and you need to get transported out of there, because there's not going to be a Lifestar to help you out. Sure, there's only a few people that get impacted, but those people that are actually there that need the help get the help from Lifestar when they need it. You just don't want to be that person either way. But on the other hand, those are the kinds of programs that are funded in part by the state. That just won't be there. And so everywhere you turn around, there are state services, there are state programs, most of which we just take for granted and don't pay attention to, especially things, some of the most visible end up being plowing the roads in the wintertime. What happens if we get cut back on the budget for snow plows and salt and all those types of things? Well, we don't realize that problem until it snows 2 or 3 feet, and then all of a sudden we're caught in a box. But the bottom line is that Connecticut, I think, takes pride, and a lot of people stay here, because we have a really good quality of life. And, of course, we have to pay for some of those services. But the governor feels fully assured and easy to make the decision that she's going to go and diminish the quality of life for most people. And the deal is that what she wants to do is protect the extreme wealth in this state. And like I said, most of the other states around us have raised their income tax rates on the higher earners, the wage earners. They could well afford it. A person making $1 million a year, I think it amounts to about an additional, the income tax rate that we were talking about amounted to about a $20 a week increase. And, you know, someone who's making $12,000 a week, I don't know, is really going to feel the pinch by losing another $20 a week out of their pocket. I mean, I don't want to sound crass or crude or wealth envious or anything, but the fact of the matter is that when you're taking away a service from someone who can't afford to live in their homes for the benefit of making sure someone who's making $12,000 a week doesn't have to part with $20, I think there's a little bit wrong with the priorities, but the governor's trying to protect her people, so that's pretty much what it's all about here.
Well, I know there was a protest at the Capitol recently by the billionaires for Jody Rell.
Billionaires for budget cuts.
Yeah, right. Which was quite funny. I mean, I've seen the billionaires for Bush over the years of that,
yep.
8 years of the administration, and they had a little bit of humor and reality all in the little kind of performance that they did at the steps of the Capitol. It was quite something. I don't know. People can see that on YouTube, I think. But
yep, there is a video on it. And so it's out there. If you Google up billionaires for budget cuts, I'm sure you're gonna be able to find it. But the issue is, when I helped to arrange the limousines and other things, I was kind of like the one of the stage managers for the event. So it was a lot of fun, but a very pointed message. The fact of the matter is, and which is absolutely true, when you talk about the economy of scale. You know, when billionaires can actually, if the state cuts its budget, therefore not needing the extra taxes from billionaires, then they get to go and put the leather in the new Beamer and stuff like that. And there are trade-offs that will be made. And the fact is that if we don't tap into some of the wealth that we have, and we actually have, Connecticut is amongst the lower tax rate states. You know, it's not like if we're going to raise our taxes a point or two on the extremely wealthy here, that they're all going to run away from the state and move somewhere else. Well, they just can't get somewhere. I mean, the closest might be Florida, maybe a state or two between there. But the fact of the matter is there's an awful lot about Connecticut that people like and would be willing to shell out a little bit more to help pay for it. But the Connecticut tax rate in the 5 percentage point areas, you know, versus Vermont, which is up in the 7s, and New York is up in the 6s, and they raised their rates this year. I mean, the fact of the matter is that we would be competitive when it came to those market rates for the income tax levels for people earning over $500,000 a year. So we're not exactly sure what it is, if there is a real love for, you know, and the billionaires gotta love Jody Rell, because every time she holds out on a tax increase for them, they make out like bandits. And so that was kind of the gist, and what we were doing in our event was letting people see from a different perspective of who really benefits. Who really benefits from the governor's program? Well, it's really the extremely wealthy in our state are the people who benefit, because everybody else is going to take a hit one way or another. And early on in her speech to the General Assembly, she says we want to have shared sacrifices. Well, it's only been a one-way street there. The sacrifices, you know, the state employees gave up things to help out. People who are going to lose their services are giving up things, and the very wealthy in this state really have not had an opportunity to chip in. And I think there are a lot of wealthy people who understand that there's not a big impact, and probably would be willing to help out. But on the other hand, the governor's not offering them that choice.
Leo, I wanted to get your comment on what the Democrats describe as their revised plan, which includes $250 million in spending cuts and lowering tax increases from $2.5 billion in their previous budget proposal to $1.8 billion, including increases in the personal income tax, cigarette tax, and on the corporate surcharge. And the Democrats also expect to include a proposal to eliminate the State Department of Motor Vehicles, dividing it up among three other agencies. Not sure what your view is of this, but you know, it's been criticized as not really being substantive. What do you think?
Look, you know, I think the governor and the legislature have all been looking at different ways of trying to affect changes to make our state government perform better. I think that's a very good a mutual desire on the part of the elected officials to try to do that, and I think it's a great thing to do. State employees and the people I represent, we want efficiencies. I mean, my members are out there saying, if we could only do this way, if only we could change that. one of the problems ends up being is that in order to affect the changes, and I think corporate America knows this very well, is that if you want to go from system A to system B, you need to invest certain resources in doing it. And what ends up happening with our legislature and with the governor is they want to go from system A to system B for free. It just doesn't happen. I mean, you need to have training. You need to have equipment. You need to have all these things in order to make that happen. You need to have a good integration plan and a transition plan. You need to have all these things that need to be in place and working at the right way at the right time in order to do that. And so if you want to take the Department of Motor Vehicles, sure, there are things that we could be doing to make them work more efficiently. But the fact is that no one has that real plan about how to get from system A to system B. And then at the point in time when you want to talk about it, you can save money in the long run by having certain things that are more efficient. But that means you have to come up with the money in the beginning in order to affect those changes or spread those changes out over a longer period of time. So you could try to have this nice, transparent, and very quick, or very, you know, lengthy as it gets evolved in their transition program. None of that is really coming out. So the legislature is looking at ways to try to come up with ideas. I think that there are some merits in terms of doing it, but usually, like a lot of other things, the devil's in the details. How are you going to get there? How are you going to prevent, avoid the system interruptions and all those other things that are involved in it? What's it going to cost to do it? And a whole bunch of those things that I don't think are really worked out. But everybody's struggling to try to find some way to find the round pegs to fit in the round holes when it comes to putting the pieces of the budget together so that it works. Now, and is it going to save a lot of money? No. I mean, you know, if we're $2 billion short, that isn't going to be, it's not going to come close. But I think what the Democratic caucus wants to demonstrate is they have a willingness to look at things, to try things, to see where that they can go, because they just can't get past the governor, who is locked in her routine of trying to protect billionaires in our state. You know, I mean, it's a very difficult environment to work with when the governor of the state of Connecticut is serving more of the wealthy population than she is for the rest of the population in the state.
Leo, just finally, I wanted to ask you about what are the consequences, you think, for state employees in terms of layoffs, given the couple of different menus of cutbacks we have here from Jody Rell, the Republican governor, and the Democratic State House and Senate. Are you guys in for a decimation of your numbers and your ranks, or...?
Well, look, our people really are committed to the jobs that they do. They want to provide the services that people need, that people want, that help to enhance the quality of life and protect those people who really need the help. It's the people of Connecticut that end up becoming the losers when you start wiping out state employees and the services that they're providing. And so our main focus always has been with InThisTogetherCT.org, with the state employees in CBAC, the group called Better Choices, really saying what we want to be is a state that people really want to live in and can live in and are protected. And so when we start reducing workforces with public services, you start eroding that safety net. You start eroding that quality of life. Now, the CBAC has a two-year agreement, so there really can't be layoffs within this time frame unless everything falls apart, which it could. But the fact of the matter is the governor actually is part of our agreement. We came up with $800 million worth of savings in trade, which included the departure of 4,000 workers. So we're down in the range of 7 or 8% of the workforce is already out the door. And so layoffs are really not one of the major options for most of the programs that are out there. The trick comes in the year 2011. That is going to be probably a worse year to deal with than this year, because if we're going to balance budget with one-shot revenues that end in a couple of years, what are we going to do to fill the gaps at that point in time? So there may be a bigger fight in 2011 than there was this year over the whole issue, because the governor in particular is trying to do everything that she can to put it off. That kind of makes me think that she's not going to run, because I don't think even she would want to be around when she has to meet up with all the consequences of the bad deal she's trying to put together right now. So I would say that there's going to be a bigger crisis at that point in time, and we'll have to confront it when it comes, unless, of course, this year, next year, we could actually derive a better revenue portfolio that meets the needs now and actually moves us to solve problems for the next 5, 10, 20 years down the road. And we can do it. I think there's an opportunity to do it. We're pushing for it everywhere we can, sometimes with humor, sometimes with direct forces. But the bottom line is we do need to have a better revenue structure in the state than the one we currently have, and some of the ideas the governor's been putting out there are really bad ideas.
Well, Leo Canty, it's been great to have your analysis here on this budget crisis here in Connecticut, and we'd love to have you back to talk more about Connecticut economic and political issues. But our listeners can see your column in the Journal Inquirer newspaper. It's the Connecticut at Work column. And what's a website they can see the column? And also, please do give the website for the coalition that you're working with in
sure.
this Together Connecticut.
Well, the journalinquirer.com is the website that actually carries the column, but you need to be a subscriber. But my column is also available on ctatwork.blogspot.com. So the columns are there, and you don't have to subscribe to the JI. But, you know, if you feel up to it and you need a reason to subscribe to the Journal Inquirer, feel free to do so. And the actual Billionaires for Budget Cuts was coming out of the Connecticut Working Families Group, ct-workingfamilies.org. That's where we're actually, there might be another little bunch of billionaires driving up in a limousine to visit with the governor at her mansion tomorrow. We'll see whether or not they get in.
We enjoy that hot
budget negotiation.
We like that hot tip there. So thanks. And In This Together Connecticut, is there a website for that group?
InThisTogetherCT.org. That is a place where the CBAC and community groups and all those are actually are talking about the whole service, the Connecticut service delivery structure and the need for public services. So there's lots of information. And I think, you know, if people feel like I do, that we have a great state, we want to have good services, we want to make sure our people are protected, and we all want to have a fair and balanced tax structure that actually works for all of us. And I think that that's the underlying issue that we're pursuing. And we may have our differences with the governor. I'm sure that she wants the same thing. But I think from our perspective, she's missing the mark when it comes to the way to get it done.
Well, Leo, again, thanks for your time and analysis tonight on the Connecticut budget issues. We'll love to have you back again. So we'll stay in touch and appreciate you being here. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Thanks. Bye-bye. That was Leo Canty, Vice President of the American Federation of Teachers Connecticut Union, which represents 26,000 state and municipal employees. We're going to take a quick message here, an important benefit coming up for WPKN Radio this Thursday night. So take a listen to this, and we'll say goodnight.
Light the lava lamp. Here comes the concert you've been waiting for. The Electric Prunes, Love with Johnny Eccles and Baby Lemonade, and the Blues Magoos, as they turn the clock back to Music of California in 1966. Hear the music that started it all in a one-time live show, as only the people that created it all can present. This is not a tribute or a copy. This is the real thing. The Electric Prunes, Love. The Blues Magoos, California 66. This may be your last chance. California 66 is a benefit concert for WPKN Radio on Thursday, August 6th at the Quick Center, Fairfield University in Fairfield, Connecticut. Tickets are available online at quickcenter.com or through the box office at 203-254-4010. California 66 benefit tickets are $66 for adults and $33 for students and are tax deductible to the extent allowed. This benefit concert for WPKN is dedicated to the late Sky Saxon from the Seas.
Well, that's it for our program tonight. We hope you can make it to that unique and very interesting blast from the past, the Blues Magoos, Love and the Electric Prunes, one of the only performances that this group of artists will be doing this year, because a national tour got kind of screwed up. But this will be a performance that will happen this Thursday at the Quick Center in Fairfield. Call the station for more information about tickets. That's 203-331-9756. And we have We have an unknown programmer who will be here in just a moment, so do stay tuned. This is WPKM in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. Please stay tuned, and we will be back next Monday evening between 8 and 10 here on WPKM with another Counterpoint program. So we hope you'll join us then, and do stay tuned to the station throughout the week and contribute generously to keep this listener-sponsored station on the air. Stay with us.
He had time, had the world in his pocket. You never rock it, chilly, chilly, smooth. Never tip the ship if it ain't broke. Don't fix it. 20 years drinking beers, slapping facts. One vacation, one heart attack. Honest work, honest pay, honest pound. Just an American lad and his lassie. 20 years popping ribbons in a chassis. American dream died in his sleep. Kids gone hungry when you get the pink sheep. You're looking down, the plan is closed. We get laid off, Bob gets paid off. What you gonna do when you get home? Winter in America, chills to the bone. Winter in America, chills to the bone. You walk the streets all day. 3 months, no job, no pay. You gotta believe the system works for you, but it's a power lunch. You're the beef stew. Your wife's out looking for a slave. 4 kids sitting home alone. You tried to raise them right, but before you know, they've been sucking on a crack pipe. Feeling weak, guns at your back. Kids gone hungry. Bob's kids have a Big Mac. Okay, chilling. You know this won't last long. Word to the president. He says there's nothing wrong. Winter in America chills to the bone. Birth to your fifth child, a hunger screams drive you wild. What's 20 years in the union for? Congratulations, you're one of the four. Pray to the Lord for a friend. Empty pockets tell you to fend for yourself. Put your self-respect on the shelf. Yo, you get no help. Initiation to the welfare line, emasculation complete. Your beef, damn. Down crying. Winter in America chills to the bone. Winter in America, you're on your own.
Yes, where else but on PKN 89.5 FM Bridgeport, WPKM 88.7 FM Montauk, and the worldwide delicious web WPKN.org. And if you'd like to make a non-strings-attached donation, you can go to WPKN.org. WPKN's open format allows for many individual views and opinions, but the views and opinions expressed are those of the people expressing them, not WPKN itself. If you wish to respond with your viewpoint, call the general manager weekdays from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., at 203-331-9756 or send an email to WPKN.org. And you know what that means? That means we have a Freedom of Doctrine Act. You can come in and you can record anything you want. We will not censor you, and we'll play it at a prime time. And also, we will play it at the late night hour. My name is, and it always has been, Mr. Mark. Yes, Mr. Mark Mueller. And this show is dedicated to Robert Andrew Mueller. And due to physical ailments, this cat has been having problems. He came in the studio about a year and a half ago. And I love this song so much, I play it until hell freezes over. Let's give Mr. Tom Korsh and his great song, What Are We Fighting For? PKN, PKM, and WPKN.org. Mark Mueller, Mark Mueller, Mark Mueller, until the big 2 a.m. hour. Mark Muller's New Music Network radio show, and classic rock.
Ready? And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? All this trouble in Iraq, Iran, is getting worse in Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up pearly gate. Ain't no time to wonder why, I believe I'm gonna die. Well, come on, boys, get a piece of the action. Looks like this is a chain reaction. And come on, girls, I'm taking bets on how many coffins, how many jets, and how many people are coming home. How many pieces and how many bones? And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. It's twice as bad as Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gate. Ain't no time to wonder why, I believe we're all gonna die. Well, listen, girls, and listen right. When you take your husband into bed tonight, you better make some children when you turn out the light, cause we're gonna need them for the great big fight. And you better make plenty, cause it ain't funny, we're gonna fight until 2020. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? That's me, I don't give a damn, it's twice as bad as Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates. Ain't no time to wonder why, I believe we're all gonna die. Well, when I said 2020, that was in 2002, and we're still going strong, so I don't know what to make of this. But anyway.
Country music renaissance man through the years. After being named after Marty Robbins, he was destined for great things even as a little kid and didn't even know it, perhaps. He's one of our greatest treasures, without a doubt. He made his debut on this very stage when he was 13 years old, working with Lester Flatt and the Nashville Grants. He's a proud member of our Grand Ole Opry family. You're going to be royally entertained, ladies and gentlemen, tonight by the one and only Marty Stewart and his fabulous superlatives.